This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Yesterday evening, the publisher and the executive editor of the New York Times convened an unprecedented staff meeting to address the issues raised by the Jason Blair scandal. Blair, a young reporter at the Times, came under suspicion of plagiarism for his story about the family of an American soldier killed in Iraq. Then more allegations emerged, and the Times launched an internal investigation that uncovered a pattern of careless mistakes, faked facts, and imaginary sources in dozens of stories dating back years. At this point, no one really knows why Jason Blair did it. Some of the issues involve the management and personalities in charge at the Times. Those are important since the New York Times is one of the most respected media outlets in the world. But Jason Blair is hardly the first reporter to make up news. The incident raises wider questions about credibility and integrity and how readers and listeners can be sure what they read and hear is fact and not fiction. What went wrong? How does this scandal affect the already shaky relationship between the public and the press? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Officials at the New York Times declined our invitation to participate in this program. Joining us now, though, is Seth Mnookin, a media reporter for Newsweek magazine. He's with us by phone from his office in New York, and it's good of you to be with us.
It's great to be here.
There was, as we mentioned, that extraordinary meeting of the staff of the New York Times yesterday, by all accounts at times, at least an angry meeting. And today, Howell Raines, executive editor of the Times, issued an apology of sorts.
Which is really an extraordinary step for Howell and for the Times. Howell's known throughout his career for being a somewhat autocratic, somewhat arrogant manager, obviously on top of being an incredibly skilled journalist. And those were some of the concerns that were raised yesterday. Why has the New York Times turned into a sort of top-down institution? Why is there this sense that some of the editors and a lot of the reporters aren't being respected and listened to? And the reason that those issues came up in this case is because there were a lot of people on staff who had raised very serious questions about Jason Blair and his work habits and his reporting before this all exploded in the past month.
Including one of his previous editors.
Right. Jonathan Landman, who had been supervising Jason on the Metro desk, had raised some concerns. Some people in Washington had raised some concerns about Jason when he was sent down to cover the sniper story. And it seems like, for whatever reason, he was continually given bigger and more prominent assignments.
Now, the Times issued a lengthy account of its investigation of Blair's stories in last Sunday's edition. What was addressed in that report, and what questions do you think might have been left unanswered?
Well, first of all, we can't overstress how extraordinary it was for the New York Times to devote 4 pages of its Sunday edition, its most valuable and most widely circulated edition, towards correcting the record. And that's the rubric under which that entire report was printed under. And I think that shows the seriousness that they take these and how serious they take their sort of place in American journalism as being the gold standard. What that story really detailed was focusing on the last 6 months of Jason's deceptions. From October of 2002, both in terms of the 2 pages of corrections and in terms of the narrative. It touched on the entire arc of his career, but that's where it really focused on. And I think the Times was hoping that devoting that much space and resources would really be the first step towards turning the corner. And instead, there was a lot of frustration and some anger both inside the building and outside the building about the issues that didn't get touched on. And those are issues like favoritism, whether he was favored because he was particularly close to some of the top editors, the issue of race. He was brought onto the Times as part of their minority internship program. And the story didn't really address the concerns that he had been pushed forward and some of his shortcomings had been overlooked because he was an ambitious and seemed like a talented and hungry and promising young black reporter. The management style issues weren't really addressed in that series.
And to be fair, I think some of those issues about race were raised by young African-American reporters who felt that he had trampled them on his rise to the top.
Well, yeah. Earlier last week, there was a previously scheduled meeting, but one in a series of meetings that the top editors there have with young writers and reporters on the staff. This was a meeting that Gerald Boyd, who's the managing editor and also the highest-ranking African-American on the Times' editorial side, had previously scheduled with young writers. And some of the young minority writers asked point blank at that meeting, how is this going to affect us? Are we now not going to be given the same opportunities and chances for advancement because of questions and concerns that have been raised about Jason Blair and how he was able to survive and thrive at the Times for so long?
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And John joins us on the line from Fairfax, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi.
I guess one of the things that I find interesting is that while the Times is very quick to call for outside investigations anytime there's any scandal, the NASA space shuttle thing comes to mind, how they say that certainly you can investigate yourself and expect to do a good job, they seem to want to deal with their own problems purely in-house, and they don't want to bring anybody else in to look at the problem.
Seth Manuka, now that's certainly been their attitude.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things the Times is dealing with right now is there's a sense, I think, in the culture as a whole, that the paper has had moments of institutional arrogance, of sort of looking down its nose, of it telling government institutions or financial institutions that they know the best way to go about things. And now they're conducting this in sort of a very closed-door kind of manner. And that's something they're taking a lot of criticism for. One of the things that people have said consistently about the Times preceding this whole affair is that the paper needs to hire an ombudsman, which is an independent voice in the paper who gets a committed amount of space each week to really challenge what the paper is doing, challenge the reporting methods, challenge the practices. A lot of other papers, including the Washington Post and the Boston Globe, have ombudsmans, and the Times has always resisted that. And I think that's one of the things that's being considered and talked about now in response to this.
Is anybody going to lose their job other than, of course, Jason Blair?
Well, yesterday at this meeting, Howell Raines, the executive editor, said he didn't plan on resigning. And then Arthur Sulzberger, the publisher of the Times, went even further and said not only was he not going to ask Howell to resign, but he wouldn't accept his resignation if it was offered, which is an extraordinary thing to say in light of the fact that the whole sort of investigation process hasn't been completed. But I think, you know, pretty much closes the door on that, at least for the time being. Howell essentially answers to a constituency of one, and that's Sulzberger, the publisher. And, you know, I think that was a clear indication that the paper was going to move forward with the leadership it had now, and it was time to start working on what was going to come next.
In terms of an outside investigation, there was a request, or an indication at least, that a district attorney was interested in looking into this.
Yeah, you know, I got to say, I was a little bit confused, and I remain a little bit confused, about what kind of investigation what kind of criminal investigation there would be. I mean, there was some discussion of wire fraud or mail fraud if Blair was, you know, using a phone to commit acts of fraud, and the reason he would have been doing that is because he was saying he was reporting from Baltimore or West Virginia or Texas, and in fact it seems that for most of those times he was in New York, and then sometimes even in the Times' own newsroom, or mail fraud if he was sending stuff through the mail and misrepresenting what was going on. I just don't see that kind of investigation coming to fruition, or at least resulting in some kind of prosecution. And I'm not sure where the Times' liability would be. It might be a management issue, but they certainly weren't knowingly putting faulty information in the paper.
Seth Mnookin, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Seth Mnookin is a media reporter for Newsweek magazine with us by phone from his office in New York. And again, wanted to remind you, we did invite officials from the New York Times to join us, and they declined. Joining us now is Robert Steele, director of the ethics program at the Poynter Institute, a journalism research and training school. He's with us from their studios in St. Petersburg, Florida, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
This must be all you and your colleagues are talking about there. I mean, what did you write for the Poynter Institute's website about this story?
Well, what I said is that what Jason Blair did was wrong, terribly wrong. He stole the work and the words of other journalists. He cheated on his editors. He was unfair to the people in the stories. He lied many times to many people, including his readers. Clearly, there was a dance of deceit and self-delusion going on by Jason Blair, but I also challenged the editors at the New York Times for what I believe is a failure in proper leadership and the creation of a culture there that in some ways may have produced the conditions that allowed Jason Blair to do what he did. He may still have tried to do what he did and gotten away with some of it, but the extent of his ethical indiscretions and professional irresponsibility is so great, the extent of it, that the Times editors should have been able to intervene much sooner than they did.
What do you mean by the culture that might have allowed this to go on?
Well, Hal Raines himself has said that it was in his leadership style aristocratic in the approach to it, autocratic, inaccessible, and that particular approach certainly may have lent to it. Interestingly, there are some parallels between what happened with the ethics earthquake at the New York Times and an ethics volcano at the Salt Lake Tribune in the last couple of weeks. The specific ethical breaches were different out at the Tribune in Salt Lake City. Two writers who were covering the Elizabeth Smart case met with a National Enquirer reporter and since sold themselves for $10,000 each to the Enquirer and then lied to their editor about what they'd done. But in both the New York Times situation and in the Salt Lake Tribune, that the culture that was created in the newsroom by the top editor had the autocratic, inaccessible approach to it. There was a lot of ignoring going on of challenges and warnings coming from mid-level editors. And the leaders in both cases gave very young and inexperienced journalists too much responsibility and too much freedom, and they didn't keep their hand on the tiller. The editors did not.
Let's get a question now from Marika, who joins us on the line from Buffalo, New York.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The ethical challenges faced by the New York Times seem to me to point to the same direction as many other complaints people have about the news, whether it be about war reporting or the corporate control of the newsroom, and that is simply that we must go to a number of different places to get our information.
Mm-hmm.
Try different countries, try different news outlets, and I wonder if there's any alternative solution or if that's really it.
Do you have faith that those other outlets are not suffering from the same kinds of difficulties?
Well, no. I think that the fact of the matter is that you're going to have different drawbacks with every outlet, different perspectives, and that if you're getting a holistic view by reading a number of different newspapers, listening to a number of different radio stations, et cetera, that somehow then your view is more comprehensive. You see discrepancies or possibly, you know, what could be recognized as questionable information. You can say, oh, well, I need to look into this more to mm-hmm. really believe it.
Well, Bob Steele, it's certainly, I don't think either of us are going to argue with the idea of the more you read, the more you know.
Well, certainly the caveat emptor, buyer beware concept is a good one. We should tap into lots of different information from many sources. And at the same time, those who run news organizations and those who practice journalism should make professional development a high priority and make sure that we keep getting better at not only the craftsmanship of what we do, but at our ethical decision making.
Marika, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking about the Jason Blair scandal at the New York Times and what it means for the questions of ethics and integrity in journalism and how newsroom editors can be sure to check their reporters' stories and make sure that their audiences are getting accurate, honest information. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the situation at the New York Times after a reporter was fired for fabricating quotes, inventing stories, and plagiarizing other stories from other newspapers. His name is Jason Blair. He has been dismissed. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Does this incident erode your confidence in the news business? Our guest is Bob Steele, director of the ethics program at the Poynter Institute, a journalism research and education center. And Bob, we mentioned the Poynter Institute's website earlier. Could you give us the address?
Sure. It's poynter.org, P-O-Y-N-T-E-R.org.
Okay. Now, one of the things you do at the Poynter Institute is teach courses in journalistic ethics. Is there anything directly related to this kind of a situation, which is, it's not unique, but it's certainly unusual?
Well, the extent of it is unusual in how broad and deep the ethical indiscretions were, but I'm looking at a photograph in front of me right now, taken in August of 1996, of a group of 18 college juniors and seniors from around the country who were here for a seminar we did in those years, Ethics and Leadership for College Editors. Sitting in the middle of the front row is Jason Blair. He was one of those 18 who attended that seminar. I remember him well. I ran into him a couple times after that. He interviewed me a couple times when he was writing for technology issues at the New York Times. And, you know, I think back to what might I and my colleagues have done during that seminar to help him better see the principles of journalism and to recognize he was heading into a minefield and doing what he was doing. I also look at these other 17 who were then young journalists in the making and are now all in their mid and late 20s. Several of them have gone on to the Dallas Morning News, another to the Sacramento Bee, one to the Honolulu Advertiser, one worked at the Oregonian in Salt Lake City, another one's at Bloomberg Radio, one at Fox Television in Boston, and others in the field as well. And my hope is that they represent the future of this next generation of journalists much more than what Jason Blair did in this particular case. I have no idea of the depth of what his personal problems are that led him to lie and cheat and steal as he did, and I hope he gets the help and is able to turn the corner in his personal life. But I also have great faith that these other 17, whether they're working in journalism or not, and many are, will help us become better at what we do. Mm-hmm. It's more of an art than a science in journalism. We will make mistakes, but let's hope that the experience that we've seen play out with Jason and the New York Times is one that all of us, from Bangor to Bemidji to Bozeman, St. Petersburg and St. Paul, can learn from and be better at what we do.
Let's get another caller. Foster joins us now from Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
Well, I'm Foster Winans, and your guests will know who I am because my case is taught in just about every journalism school and also securities law and others. I was the reporter who was fired in 1984 from the Wall Street Journal. I was a columnist, and although my case did not involve false information, it involved securities trading around columns that I had written for the Wall Street Journal. And your guest has said a couple things that I agree with. One is has to do with oversight. It seems to me that when I was at the Journal, one of the things that I never heard anybody sit down and talk to me about was what could go wrong and what kind of opportunities would come my way that would send me off the track. But I also think in the Times case that many editors, after many years in the business, when someone calls to complain about an accuracy in a story, they kind of dismiss it. Everybody complains. If somebody says something controversial or it comes back to haunt them, they have a tendency to sort of dismiss that person as just, you know, complaining.
Or in many cases, as you know, hey, you're just trying to cover it up.
Yes. Say that again. I'm sorry.
Or that, if somebody calls to complain, hey, I didn't say that, yeah, that's not accurate, they say, oh, you're just trying to cover it up.
I think there's often an us versus them sort of attitude in newsrooms that, we've got it right, and anybody who complains has nothing to say about it.
Well, Bob Steele, what do you think?
Well, I know Foster's case, and I do believe his point is right on target in the sense of the value of continuing conversations in the newsroom, not to excuse what he did or what Jason did or mistakes any of us make. But when we talk more among ourselves in a newsroom about what should guide us, and we talk about the danger of the landmines that are always there, and we help each other make good decisions along the way, we have a much better chance of succeeding journalistically and ethically. And that's a real important process. And I do agree with him as well that there is a sense of, and I'll use the word arrogance on the part of many news organizations and journalists and editors when they are challenged, that they just don't believe they can make a mistake. Now, there are exceptions to it, and there are many, of course, of newspapers and some broadcast organizations, including NPR, that have instituted the ombudsman concept, so there is a better pipeline, but they are by far in the minority across the country. So that's one technique to create the access points in which those who are covered by the news can raise their concerns or at least communicate internally. The other is to make sure that all journalists are open-minded and are willing to seek out and listen to the perspectives of those they cover. Absent that, the arrogance factor will continue to grow, and we will miss the kinds of mistakes that we are creating, and will breed the possibility of making many more.
Foster, we don't know why Jason Blair may have done this or did do this. Why did you do it?
Well, I think I understand a little bit what goes on in the mind of a young person. Although I'm not African-American, I did feel like an outsider. I had no college degree, no business education. I arrived at Dow Jones not knowing the difference between a stock and a bond. It turned out I was a good journalist, but I had inside of me this sort of feeling of being a fraud. I was in the wrong place. I really wasn't qualified to do what I was doing. And then I would add to that a layer of sort of immediate supervisors whose attitude was, if we don't tell you anything, you're doing a great job. The only time we will speak to you is when you're screwing up. I would like to add that this could not have happened at the Wall Street Journal. Every time there was an error in a story at the Wall Street Journal, all hell broke loose, even if it was the smallest error. And the difference being, of course, that in the Wall Street Journal, an error costs somebody money.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much. We appreciate your calling into the program.
You're welcome.
And Neil, I think his point about race is very important, that Foster, of course, is white. The two journalists in Salt Lake City were white. Mike Barnicle is white. Peter Arnett is white. And while there are other black journalists, Janet Cook, Patricia Smith, who have stumbled on the ethics issues, it's a real mistake to point the direct finger at race or the diversity program at the New York Times as a significant or sole cause in this case, absent knowing much more.
Well, joining us now is Charles Lane. As editor of The New Republic in 1998, Lane fired the then-celebrated young writer Stephen Glass for inventing many of his stories. Lane is now a staff writer for The Washington Post covering the U.S. Supreme Court, and he joins us by phone from his desk at the Supreme Court, and it's good of you to join us.
Oh, I'm happy to do it.
Can you remind briefly our listeners what Stephen Glass did and what led you to fire him?
Well, Stephen Glass was fired for fabricating all or part of 27 stories out of the 41 he wrote for The New Republic in the late 1990s. I was led to do it when I was tipped by a website of Forbes magazine that they couldn't verify one story that he'd written. That prompted me to investigate it and ultimately led us to determine, as a magazine, that he had done this in many cases.
And I, again, in the interests of accuracy, his stories were so good, he was interviewed here on NPR about stories that later turned out to have been false.
Right. I think it was on Ira Glass's show, but there's no relation.
No, it's no relation, and it was not on Ira Glass's show. Well, it may have been also on Ira Glass's show, but it was also on one of our magazine programs.
I see.
How long did it take you to discover problems in Glass's work? And, you know, as you've gone back over it, I mean, his stories were so good. I mean, these stories were great. How much do you do you ever wonder about yourself? You know, you were willing to believe it because it was so good.
Well, I'm sorry to say it took us all the way until 41 stories had made it to be alerted by someone from the outside, much as the Times was ultimately alerted from the outside about Jason Blair. I guess part of the reason he got away with it for so long was that even though the stories seemed improbable and almost too colorful and too interesting to be true,
yeah,
each time he did it, they acquired more credibility because you began to just accept the fact that, well, Stephen Glass has a knack for doing that. And so, ironically, instead of becoming more suspicious as he went along, those of us who worked for the New Republic became less suspicious.
It's interesting. Here's an email we got from Milt Shook in Baltimore. He raises a point. The only thing that will fix the problem of journalistic ethics is to end this fiction of the scoop. Right now, news media are far too intent on coming up with sensational stories and doing so as quickly as possible, not intent enough on getting the story right. Now, speed was not an issue necessarily at the New Republic, but certainly these were sensational stories.
Yeah, I think that the problem that was reflected in the Glass affair may have been not so much a scoop mentality, but the idea that you know, we as a magazine felt there was a niche to be filled for the offbeat, you know, with a political magazine, a story that was sort of related to politics but had more humor and dash to it a little bit. And Steve seemed to be filling that niche. It was unfortunate that I think he was responding, and we have to be very honest about that. He was responding to what was being demanded. Now, that's not to say that legitimate stories of that nature couldn't have been done, and in fact, they were done by lots of people. But he exploited that that wish of his editors to do his thing.
Can you address now? Obviously, you're not at the New York Times. You weren't at that meeting last night. But I was wondering, given your experience at the New Republic, can you address the kind of sense of betrayal and anger that you and your colleagues felt when this came public?
Well, certainly we were very angry at Steve. It was kind of like going through the looking glass, you know, because on the day before, you assume all is well and you're dealing with a trustworthy person and it's, his stories are normal. And then on day two, you're in a different world. You're in a world where you've been lied to systematically. And suddenly you begin to doubt everything you've been believing all this time, not just about Steve Glass and his articles, but about everyone. And you see, in that way, part of what makes you angry is that he's succeeded in destroying your ability to trust anyone, at least for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
As the years have gone by, you know, I've tried to become a little more lighthearted about it, and also to take away some lessons for myself as a journalist, and to understand, you know, just how imperfect we really are, how imperfect the process is, how much it really hinges on the vagaries of individual character, and ultimately also to have a little bit more humility when we are covering other institutions and their leaders who seem to be breaking down and having problems, because after all, as the Glass case shows and the Blair case shows, we ourselves are, you know, we're ostensibly leaders of institutions, and things can happen that things can go wrong on our watch, too.
One final question. This is all coming up another episode, because Stephen Glass has just published a novel, a thinly veiled, sort of a novel, I guess, a thinly veiled description of what went on. And somebody pointed out that the only name unchanged is his own.
Right.
There is a feeling that not only did he commit a journalistic crime, he's now cashing in on it.
Well, I sort of agree with that, to be perfectly blunt. I've read the book, and I gather he's been paid quite a bit of money for it. And, you know, I think the book is a very complicated examination or revelation of what Steve Glass, the real one, is all about. And it's hard to explain my emotions as I read through it. But to me, as a reader and as somebody who's familiar with those events, it's evident that he is in some ways still very angry at the people who caught him. He's ostensibly apologetic, and he repeats apologies, but a lot of the things he says in the book suggest that he feels that maybe this has all been taken to an extreme and that he's being pilloried or something like that. So I think people will just judge for themselves when they read the book how much of a lesson he's really learned from it. But hey, you know, it's a free country. You're allowed to write whatever you want, and if people buy the book, they'll buy the book. But I'm just going to go back and try and do my job and get on with life.
Charles Lane, thanks very much.
I was glad to do it, Neil.
Charles Lane, former editor of the New Republic, currently Supreme Court reporter for the Washington Post, and he was with us from his office in Washington. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Later in the program, we'll discuss the psychological effects of living under dictatorship, but now let's continue our conversation about maintaining integrity in the media. Bob Steele, chief of the Ethics Department at the Poynter Institute, is still with us from Florida, and let's get another call. Elizabeth joins us on the line from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi, yes. Let me preface my question with a couple of statements. Neil, I had the pleasure of meeting you when you were here.
Oh, thank you.
Much Ado About Books. It was a pleasure to meet you. I've worked in television media, and I wasn't a news person per se. I was a community relations person. But I found what Bob Steele said about the arrogance of those inside a newsroom to be very much so. If you're not inside the newsroom, if you're not a reporter, anything that you say or bring to the newsroom is not worthy. So I would like to make that statement. And secondly, my question is, why is some of the media playing up the whole minority and race issue when we have so many others who actually violated the trust? We've got Barnacle of the Boston Globe, and, you know, he still writes, and he's somewhat of a celebrity. And it does harm not just to the credibility of black journalists who, quite frankly, inside the newsroom, as I've witnessed myself, the tremendous challenges and struggle and fight to be taken seriously and to be respected. And I am not condoning Jason Blair one bit, but I'm a little bit angry at how so many of the reports are saying that it is because of the New York Times minority program and you know, trying to get young African Americans. That is what really bothers me.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bob Steele?
Well, I mentioned my thoughts on this a little while ago, Neil, but let me just hit the high points. And I believe it's very appropriate for news organizations in particular, and all organizations in society, to find ways to have employees who reflect the community in which they operate. In journalism, it's especially important because we have to go out and tell the stories of people in our communities. And if we don't connect with them, reflect them in ways from skin color to class to language skills to ideology, as best as possible, and we're not going to be able to get to the truth of the stories in ways in which it's not only factually accurate, but contextually authentic. And I believe it is problematic in this case and others when critics immediately throw the race card on the table and say that that is the problem. It's reasonable to ask some questions about the minority training program at the New York Times and make sure it's functioning to the degree it should, but to ascribe it as something that is inappropriate, improper, and led to this explosion is, in my mind, a wrong step.
Well, Elizabeth, excuse me just a second, but one of the criticisms that was made was that Jason Blair was promoted and his career was advanced and his errors were, in a sense, overlooked, the one chance too many that Howell Raines talked about, because they were interested in promoting the career of an energetic and promising young black reporter.
Well, that happens all the time with white reporters across the country. It happened in some degree in Salt Lake City. I was out there and spent a couple days at that paper observing what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happened many other places, and not just with young people, but with veterans. There are many white guys like myself in their 50s that got breaks through the years because we happen to be white guys.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Steele. And having worked behind the scenes in a newsroom, I can tell you that is so. I mean, some egregious errors I have seen overlooked on the part of white reporters and yet as soon as a minority reporter makes a mistake, they are hung, drawn, and quartered for it. So I've seen both sides of the coin. And the other thing I want to say about the erosion of trust.
And very quickly, please.
I do want to say that having worked behind the scenes, my trust was eroded right away because I still think the news is not being reported accurately. It is still being filtered very much through party lines and through race lines and through socioeconomic lines. So I just needed to make that point as well. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Elizabeth. We'll wrap up our discussion of the Jason Blair incident when we come back from a short break and take some more of your calls. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, join guest host David Kestenbaum on Science Friday. He'll be talking about a report on this week's terror tests in Chicago and Seattle, plus a plan to send a probe on a journey to the center of the Earth, and the latest on SARS from China. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. We're wrapping up our discussion of Jason Blair and the New York Times and the various responsibilities of a reporter who fabricated stories and a management which overlooked his errors. Our guest is Bob Steele, and he is director of the Ethics Program at the Poynter Institute of Journalism. And let's go get a call from Dan, and Dan's on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi, Neil. Interesting discussion. I've been a journalist for 30 or 40 years in several cities, among them New York. Worked at the New York Times for about 4 years in the 60s. And it is indeed a kind of an egocentric, prideful organization, but still I think a magnificent one and should clean this thing up by itself. But the crisis, I think, is for the whole profession of journalism. And it involves, as someone said before, the need to produce the compelling story above everything else rather than the accurate story. And if this is going to make us look again and indeed to start being suspicious of the story that's too interesting to be true, it's going to be a very good crisis. And race has nothing to do with this.
Mm-hmm. How much do you think, Bob Steele, that has to do with it?
Well, it is a factor. Competition can drive us to some of our best reporting, of course, particularly in investigative reporting, but even sometimes in just covering our community, to know that there's another newspaper or television station or network or radio network that's working on it. We may just have a little more incentive to do it. And if we keep that within the right perspective, the right proportion, we can do good journalism. But we have to be careful to make sure that competitive instinct doesn't turn into a zeal that blinds us to our ethical principles and values and keeps us from making good ethical decisions when we're in what is often a minefield of ethical problems.
Well, that's true, but the competition has to be to find out what really happened, to find out how to really spell the names, to deal with, if not truth, at least the facts, and perhaps to downplay drama.
It's a good point. We have to be very cautious. I think too often we ratchet up the drama in a particular story to make it more compelling. Ideally, good writing, good photography, tight editing, good producing and broadcast will create the kind of storytelling that produces good reactions from people. I always say the best of journalism evokes and provokes. It evokes reasonable, meaningful emotion, and it provokes people to respond in important ways.
And records the truth accurately.
It sure does.
Let me just follow up for a moment on that competition angle. One of the local papers here in Washington, the City Paper, argued that one of the reasons the Times may have overlooked some of Jason Blair's errors on the sniper story was the feeling that they had beaten the Washington Post in its own backyard.
Well, that's probably part of the equation here. I don't doubt that there was cheering going on, at least in the hearts of the editors at the New York Times, when they were able to pull off what they believe was a beat on those stories. And it's very important for the leaders in a newsroom to be challenging to the reporters and photographers and line editors to make sure that they're working hard, they're digging, they're looking in dark corners. But editors are also the ones that should know when to pull the leash a bit tighter and make sure that somebody's not letting the competitive instinct run amok in order just to get the beat, either for themselves or the organization.
And what's interesting is how little the general reader cares about that. I mean, television is before anybody anyway, so you know, get it right, even if you do have to wait.
Well, Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
One final email on this question. Daniel Turdeman writes from San Francisco. When I was at Columbia Journalism School, one thing we heard a lot about was fellow students saying, I wish I could get a job at the Times when I graduate. But professors would warn that going straight to the Times wasn't what we wanted, because once you got there, the pressure is so strong, the room for error is so small, that if you weren't ready, you would crack. Jason Blair was 27. I think he's proof, as was Stephen Glass, that putting stars in these positions of glory before they're ready is likely to produce these kinds of results.
I think that frames at least one key element of this situation, Neil, that Jason was in water that was at least up to his eyeballs, if not over his head. And I sure wish I could turn back the clock for him, and I bet the folks at the New York Times do as well. Right now, we should ask Jason Blair, what can we do to help you out with your personal problems? And we should do our best as journalists all over the country in the roles we play to make sure that we look in the mirror. Where are our shortcomings? Where are our competent skills right now? And how can we ratchet them up in terms of journalism and ethics? And organizationally, we must make sure that the culture is one which produces lots of respect and responsibility internally so that we don't get into minefields and set off these kinds of explosions.
Robert Steele, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks for asking, Neil.
Robert Steele is director of the Ethics Program at the Poynter Institute, a journalism research and training school, and he was with us from their studios in St. Petersburg, Florida.